little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to our very long-distance guest on this episode.
Today's episode, the discussion with our guest centers on kids and critical thinking, and includes why it's important for kids to learn critical thinking, the relationship between kids' cognitive development and their ability to master various critical thinking skills, features of a unique website which uses video and storytelling to teach kids critical thinking skills, and the use of artificial intelligence as an aid in teaching critical thinking, and a variety of other topics.
And with a bachelor's degree in biology and a master's degree in philosophy, a couple of my favorite combinations, our guest for this episode, Stephanie Simos, found in her experience as a teacher that effective science teaching involved not only teaching course content, but also required teaching students critical thinking, like media literacy, data analysis, how their biases shape their interpretations, and so on. So her life and career path led her to develop CritiKid. It's a website for kids, teens, teachers, and others that gives instruction in logic, communication, as well as media, statistical, and data literacy by blending storytelling with interactive activities. And with her mission being, and this is a quote, to make critical thinking education accessible and engaging for people of all ages. Stephanie Simos, joining us from Tbilisi, Georgia. Now, that's not the state of Georgia, but the country of Georgia. That's why it's very long distance. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. Yours must be an interesting path from, as Bob mentioned, earning a bachelor's and master's degree at schools in Ontario, Canada, now living in the Republic of Georgia, and developing a business and website uniquely designed to teach kids critical thinking, a topic we haven't broached a lot here on Thinking Clearly. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch kind of describing that journey and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, so my journey didn't take me straight from Canada to Georgia. I actually lived in Thailand for 5 years before I was here, working as an international teacher. But I've been in Georgia for about 5 years now, and I absolutely love it here. And it's also a great place to start a business. So I started my business, CritiKid, while living here. I think much easier than starting a business in Canada because of the lower cost of living. So I can work part-time on other projects to cover all my living expenses and then have half my time reserved for working on CritiKid. Georgia is also a great country tax-wise for starting a small business.
As Bob mentioned, you got your bachelor's in biology, which you know, some would refer to as a hard science, and your master's in philosophy, which I think many would consider not a science, but a combination that Bob and I do love. Could you tell us a little bit more about kind of how you went from biology to philosophy and how that came together with what you're doing now?
Actually, to clarify, I also have a bachelor's in philosophy. So I did both at the same time. So a lot of people at that time said it was a really strange combination. And I don't know anyone else who combined those two majors, but they're both trying to understand the world just from a different perspective. So I think that they complemented each other really well. And I think that they've come together nicely for this project, the critical thinking site for kids, because I do think science literacy is a really important part of critical thinking because it helps us to understand the information that we encounter on the internet. We don't have to spend much time on the internet to see how much science literacy is lacking among adults. And then the philosophy side of things brings in the formal logic, how to build and analyze rational arguments. So they both play a role in critical thinking.
And it seems like your experience of actually teaching the subject matters brought you in some way to thinking that critical thinking was important. And we've had other guests that had that same discovery. I want to get your thoughts on this. Why critical thinking is important for us all, and why it's important to teach at an early age.
Yeah, so it's important for all of us because it helps us filter information and evaluate claims. And it also helps us to communicate more clearly. This is especially important in the age of the internet, where we're confronted with all sorts of claims and opinions and information. Even sometimes if the facts are true, they can be presented in a misleading way. So critical thinking is becoming even more important because of all this information that we're constantly facing, and because we have opportunities to interact with people all the time in social media comment sections and so on. And that's a place where you can see that critical thinking skills are lacking as well, through logical fallacies and stuff like that. And I think it's particularly important to teach at an early age, well, just because we can, because I don't think any of us who are adults now really had critical thinking education as children. And we're seeing the results of that now. But when I was teaching kids, I tried introducing some critical thinking topics to them, and they could understand that stuff. I would tell them stories where the characters commit logical fallacies, and then they would have to try to make their own stories with characters committing those logical fallacies. And I think stories are a really good way of making abstract concepts more concrete, and also just makes it fun. That's why I use a lot of stories on my website. And so because we can, I think that we should. We're seeing, like I mentioned, lack of communication skills online, data being misinterpreted, and a lack of intellectual humility, which is probably the most important part of critical thinking. People are very overly confident in their abilities to do their own research, for example, without understanding their limitations.
And the phrase, do your own research, has almost become code for go find all the things you can to prove that your ideas or belief are right. Critical thinking can tell us of those dangers, and that's part of the cognitive vulnerabilities that we talk a lot about. On this show, we probably do not have a lot of people that really need critical thinking. I get the impression that most of our listeners want to sharpen their skills. They already have a predisposition to be interested in critical thinking. Sometimes I think we're not going to get through to some of the people that are spinning some of those conspiracy theories or willing to weaponize information and live in a completely alternate universe in terms of reality. It's kind of like we can't make much impact on some of those folks that have learned the bad habits. So let's start with the kids. I mean, that's where my mind goes. And if I was asked that question, I go, because that's where we can do the most good.
Yeah, it's definitely easier to start in childhood. I tend to take a somewhat optimistic view in terms of getting through to adults. It's just, it's difficult and it takes a lot of time. So I agree with you that we should just start younger before certain bad habits become normal.
Speaking of sort of the developmental angle, it seems like a key principle in curriculum development for children and learning situations is to make topics of instruction align with typical stages and sequences of children's cognitive development. Probably wouldn't work well if we're teaching calculus in kindergarten, for instance. From your experience teaching critical thinking to kids, what might be the earliest age that a child could begin with that instruction?
So my personal experience is with kids ages 8 and up. For the younger children, I worked with a child psychologist named Dr. Ronald Crouch to develop an emotional intelligence course. So this is for ages 5 and up. Because emotional intelligence and critical thinking are really inseparable. Because if we have trouble managing our emotions, it can be hard to think clearly. So the skills to understand our emotions and calm down when we need to can help us to be better critical thinkers. And Dr. Ronald Crouch also had a great recommendation for kids as young as age 4 to have an at-home Scooby-Doo adventure where you go around your house looking for evidence, evaluating the strength of evidence, like, is this good enough evidence that there's a ghost, in the attic, and testing certain ideas that they have. So that's a great way to make it fun. But with the age groups I'm more experienced within, ages 8 and up, I find that at age 8, you can start teaching logical fallacies. Sometimes even at age 7, it depends a little bit on the child. So there's a little bit of flexibility there. But at age 8 is when I'll start telling these stories where characters commit fallacies. And then by age 10 to 12, I'd say you can start teaching data analysis. At age 10, maybe more simple things like correlation versus causation. And then by age 12, you can get into more advanced topics like Simpson's paradox to help them understand the information that they're inevitably going to encounter on the internet. And I start teaching formal logic at age 13, which I know is kind of unusual. Most people don't learn formal logic at all unless they take a university philosophy course. So most people don't learn it until they're 17 or 18. That was my experience. But I think that it can be taught to 13-year-olds. And one thing that we can do for all ages is model critical thinking. Dr. Ronald Crouch actually wrote an article for CritiKids blog about a technique he didn't invent this technique. I'm not sure the name of the psychologist who came up with this term. It's in the article, though. It's called model label praise. So you model critical thinking, you model looking for evidence or being skeptical. And then when you see your kids showing these behaviors as well, then you label it and praise them for it. Like, oh, you're doing such a great job asking Socratic questions. I mean, that might be a little advanced. That'd be for older kids, but you phrase it in an age-appropriate way. So that you can start, you know, at any age. And I'd also say, and this might be really hard for adults, but modeling intellectual humility, saying, I don't know, to kids, even saying, I was wrong.
I have two twin grandchildren. They're 7 years old, and I use terms like Socratic with those kids because they're very inquisitive. And then they'll ask, what does that mean? Grandpa, what does that mean? It gives me a chance to then talk about Socrates. You can do it in a way that you can make it palatable to kids. So I know that we have to be responsive to developmental markers in education. That's very important. But I don't think it hurts for kids to hear some of these terms before they fully understand them. And you don't expect them to fully understand them, but to hear them. And that goes along with the modeling that you're talking about. Let's talk about the nuts and bolts kind of your website there, CritiKid, CritiKid, CritiKid. And I've spent a little bit of time with it. And up at the top, it has some menu items, courses, worksheets, puzzles, and blogs. Take us through the kind of the nuts and bolts of using that website and how those pieces fit together and give us an idea of who can actually benefit from engaging with the site.
So there are 5 courses right now for ages 5 to 18. So the emotional intelligence course I mentioned is for 5 to 8-year-olds. And then Fallacy Detectors is an animated science fiction course for 8 to 12-year-olds about logical fallacies. And it's not just the videos, but there's also some activities. Then my newest course is a social media simulator where kids ages 9 and up can practice spotting misinformation and manipulation in a safe and controlled environment. And the idea behind this was that kids need to learn how to use social media because they're almost inevitably going to get on it. But I understand parents don't want to just let their kids loose on social media. So this is a controlled environment where they can practice spotting red flags, spotting logical fallacies, manipulative marketing tactics, and so on. And then each problematic post has a little lesson that goes along with it so that I'm not just, you know, showing kids a whole feed filled with misinformation. For older kids, I have a statistical odyssey. This is a space adventure that teaches data analysis and my formal logic course. So these are interactive, independent, self-paced courses. And then, there are worksheets and lesson plans as well. And I've got a set of puzzle cards on there, which are free. And you can also get a printable version of that. And the reason why I love to use puzzles is for the intellectual humility side of critical thinking. It shows us that we can be wrong, and it shows us that what feels right can be wrong, which is a really important thing for critical thinkers to know. So those puzzles have a range of difficulty from easy to quite difficult, even for adults. So adults might enjoy those puzzle cards too. And then there's also a critical thinking blog where some of the articles are written by me and some are written by others. Articles about critical thinking, about teaching critical thinking, some more advanced puzzles. Those puzzles in the blog are for adults, maybe teenagers and adults. In general, my whole blog is for teens and adults, and some media literacy interviews with experts in different fields of media literacy. So the people this site is meant for is parents and teachers. And I'm hoping to get my courses into schools more. It's been used here and there by just individual teachers who purchased it for their class. But I'd love to start working with schools in a larger way, just to make the project more financially viable. And probably the biggest group of buyers has been homeschooling parents.
It's interesting. I look through what you call puzzles there, and it's what we have talked about on this show before as part of the cognitive reflection test, which helps transition people from the fast, intuitive answers to a question and the more reflective, slow, analytic thinking that we've talked about, Kahneman and Tversky, the dual process model. It's a lot of those kind of things, like a ball and a bat together cost $1.10. For anybody tuning into your Critikid website, I'd recommend going to that and challenging yourself on those, what Stephanie calls puzzles. One other thought that I had is that I looked at some of the comments that people have made about your site, and it seems that a number of people highlight and talk about, well, I work with my kids on this site. It's been fun to actually work along with them. So it kind of gives a chance for the parent not only to help and give a little more reflection to the kid using it, but it also helps the parent become engaged in critical thinking right along with the kid. So that's a strength that people have noted on the site.
Some adults have actually even done courses without kids and learned from them. The more advanced courses that I have for teens are completely suitable for adults who have no exposure to those topics. So I started labeling the courses for ages 12 and up, for ages 13 and up, instead of putting an upper limit. So adults are welcome too, even if you don't have kids.
You already touched on this a little bit, but maybe we could talk a little bit more about the specific critical thinking skills that are presently taught on the website. In addition to that, you know, which of those do you think are most challenging for kids to master?
So the current main topics are emotional intelligence, clear communication, that's the lessons about logical fallacies. And that's not just communication with others, that's also communication with ourselves, communication in our own minds when we try to think things through, because sometimes we do commit logical fallacies in our own minds. So decision-making, rational decision-making is a part of that too. Data analysis, so that's topics like, well, I already mentioned correlation versus causation, Simpson's paradox, also topics like the clustering illusion and judgment flaws that can make us commit errors when we are confronted with information. And I see this happening on the internet all the time, where people present information in a certain way that leads to conclusions that don't follow from the information. And then formal logic, and the social media simulator has all sorts of different things to look out for on social media, including some of the above, like flawed data analysis and logical fallacies. So because these are for different ages, it's hard for me to say that one is harder than the other. Generally, the formal logic and the data analysis are harder topics, but they're also for older kids. In general, I'd say the hardest part of critical thinking for everyone is the intellectual humility side of it. Knowing we can be wrong, accepting that not all our beliefs are true, and being open to changing our minds is hard for everyone. I do think it's easier for kids to develop these skills, which is why it's so important to start at an early age. And I encourage adults to work on developing those skills so they can model them to kids.
Well, one of the things I want to point out, because you've been talking about these, like you have fallacy detectors, but then in each one of these headings, you have multiple courses, multiple short modules, we could call them. So in that has 10 fallacies that you're describing. The social media simulator has 10 different lessons in it. So I want to point that out. One of the things to note is that this is not just a presentation of material. These are interactive to some extent. Can you talk a little bit about the way these courses are designed, get that interactivity going?
First lesson in every course is free. So you can test it. You can have your kids test it to make sure it's right for you. And I think this is important because I use reviews to advertise courses. I post reviews on social media. And at the same time, I post about the anecdotal fallacy and how anecdotes aren't strong evidence. So I get the irony there that I'm using anecdotes. I also know that they're powerful for sales. They make things feel more personal. But that's why I really encourage people to try the first lesson first before making a decision, because that's the best way to evaluate whether the course is right for your kids. And yeah, they are interactive. So most of the courses have, or all of the courses have, little quizzes that you go through that match the lessons. Some of the courses are video-based with quiz questions or writing activities after them. But the Statistical Odyssey, the data analysis course, is kind of like a text adventure where you're traveling through a spaceship where there's a mysterious case of memory loss where all the crew has lost their memory and you don't know why, and you're working with the ship's AI overseer to try to solve the mystery of the memory loss. So that's the most interactive course there. But they all do have an interactive aspect.
There are some technical aspects to making a course interactive like that. When I was thinking of this, it caused me to look up the difference between instruction and teaching. What is the difference between instruction? Because I sometimes use the word instruction when I really mean teaching, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. What I came to is that instruction is presenting the material out there. It's kind of going one direction. And teaching is more interactive, right? The students are getting feedback. The teacher is scaffolding material as needed when they see it. So it's much more individualized, much more interactive, and there's a real difference. So it seems like where you're going is as much teaching as you can actually build into these modules, as opposed to just instruction.
That's a good distinction. Yeah. The courses are designed that they can be used independently. So you can just, you know, set your kid up on an iPad and they can go through it on their own. But as you mentioned, some parents have said they are doing it together with their kids. So I think that's great that it's triggering a discussion over dinner time about what they learned.
And you mentioned that there is a paid portion of your website. I want to mention there are also a good portion of free things, and we already talked about the puzzles and all of the blog content, and there's some really great blog articles in there too. I would encourage people to go to the website just to read some of the blog posts that are in there, written by you and others who have contributed. John Guy, he's an ex-guest of ours. I saw him writing some of the blog posts in there. That was great. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of free content, and I recommend anyone goes to see that. But let's talk a little bit about monetization. That's tricky. It's difficult, I imagine. So I want to get into that a little bit. And as you mentioned, people can do a little sampling. There's a, if you're interested in one of the courses, for example, I think they all have a free try the first course aspect, mm-hmm. and you can do that. And what you're going to discover is that the technical aspects of the website are just very high quality. You have somebody close to you that actually does this, right? Talk a little bit about the technical aspects, and then let's talk about how you're monetizing this, where you're going, how you're trying to market this.
Yeah, so it's just my husband and I. We're the only two people on the team. I do all the content creation as well as the social media stuff for marketing, and he does all the code, all the technical work, because he's a web developer and a designer. And for the fallacy detectors course, I did hire some freelancers because I can't do animations like that on my own. Mm-hmm. But besides that, it's just been the two of us. So, and we're both working other jobs. So for now, it's still a passion project and it is hard to monetize, and we don't have a marketer on our team. And I feel like I've had to develop so many new skills since starting this project, but that's one that's just, I think you need to study for a really long time, or there's just a lot to learn. So I'm going to need to put aside some time. Either my husband or I think we'll need to do that to really learn how to do marketing, or maybe at some point bring someone else on who can help us with that. But we're not in a financial state to be able to hire someone yet. Although many people have been very kind and they've volunteered their time just to give me advice. So I'm grateful for that. People have been very supportive of the project and they just want to help out in whatever way they can. Mm-hmm. But yeah, marketing is hard. I mentioned earlier that the homeschool audience has been the most interested so far. Cricut actually got listed on the homeschool.com educational website awards for 2025. It won the category of best life skills website. So that was really nice, because now we're listed there for free, because usually getting paid to, or usually paying to get listed on those sites can be kind of expensive. So that might be where some of the homeschool interest is coming from. And I'm also right now working on a half credit course, like a one semester course, for a homeschooling website called Funda Funda Academy. So it will be hosted there, but it will be connected with some of Cricut's courses for grades 8 to 12. It should be ready in about a month. So I'm hoping to get more homeschooling families interested after that's released. Mm-hmm. Public schools are tough because they have very strict curricula that they have to follow. And I've kind of given up on working with public schools. Although if any of the listeners work at a public school and want to bring in Cricut, I'm happy to talk and even customize a course for your school. Because that's the nice thing about this being a small bootstrap project, is there's quite a bit of flexibility in terms of next courses. So if anyone from a school, public or private, is interested in developing a specific type of course, I could work with the school to do that with the hopes that other schools would also be interested because the course has been custom made for a school. So as you can see, I do want to work with schools more. It's just a little bit tough to get in with them.
It seems like if you could land a contract with a big school district somewhere, it would be something that would really help you monetize this. Thinking about the monetization made me think about the Common Core curriculum, which started many years ago. It was adopted in 2009 because Common Core, in the original Common Core curriculum, critical thinking was mentioned as one of the standards. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's been adopted and changed. Some of the states that adopted it changed it. And I see that some of them don't use the term critical thinking anymore. They use rational thinking or something else as if critical thinking were a dirty word. That might be one way to go. There's still 30 states that use it, and some use it still as a legitimate critical thinking-based approach. So if you could get in somehow getting a contract, that would be a great way to go. But yeah, I can see that the homeschooling industry would be more flexible and not just rigid in their requirements. So it would be easier. Well, good luck on that. You have the content and know how to develop the content in clear, concise, engaging ways. Your husband has great abilities that I've seen in the technical aspects of that, finding ways to make it even more interactive and make this a top-notch thing that I think some progressive educational system on board with the value of critical thinking at an early age could get on board. That would be great for you.
Talking a little bit to teachers from IB schools, because I know that IB schools highly value critical thinking and they give their teachers a lot of flexibility to design their own courses. So I do feel pretty optimistic. I've been talking to a few teachers from IB schools that might be a potential way to get into schools too.
As we had talked about, you know, since you're still developing the site, what do you hope it will look like when it's in full bloom? What do you kind of envision future possibilities?
So I try to stay pretty flexible in that way to see where things go. For example, if a school reaches out and wants a certain course, then I can work with them. Or I don't know, maybe it'll evolve in ways that I can't even predict right now. But I can talk more about the shorter term things I'm working on right now. In addition to that half credit for Funda Funda Academy, the homeschool site, I'm working on a children's book about critical thinking, about beliefs and rationality, and how when our beliefs change because rationality tells them to, it's a good thing. And that's going to be ready very soon. I'm just trying to figure out some of the tricky aspects of publishing because it's a little bit difficult when I'm located here in the Republic of Georgia and I do want to self-publish. So I think I'll put a PDF version for sale on the site very soon and then figure out how to get hard copies made. The other thing I need to work on is Fallacy Detectors Part 2 because Part 1 was released like a year and a half ago and I'm feeling a little bit guilty, like I'm worse than Netflix in how long there is between the two seasons because Fallacy Detectors Part 1 left off in a cliffhanger and kids have been asking when is Part 2 coming. The thing is, it costs money because I need to hire the animator for that one. So I'm waiting to get enough sales from Part 1 to be able to fund Part 2. So hopefully I'll be able to work on that relatively soon. I've been thinking about creating a chatbot, but I don't know how. I need to check how difficult that is to do it, or maybe my husband can do it, that can help people to explore their beliefs. Because that's one thing that chatbots are really good at, is helping people rethink their beliefs in almost more easily than other humans can. And we know that not all of our beliefs are true. I think everyone knows that, right? We believe all our beliefs are true. At the same time, we know that some of them must not be. So for people who are interested in exploring this, I thought I could design a chatbot that just helps them to think through their beliefs and helps them to question them.
And so when you say chatbot, you're referring to, I guess, what maybe some folks would call AI, the large language learning models. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? Like how those chatbots, like you said, people would be able to explore sort of their own beliefs, take a deeper dive in having that conversation with chatbots. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what that would look like.
So, I mean, people can just try it now with ChatGPT, for example. You can, for example, present it with an argument that you have and ask it to evaluate the argument, and it actually does quite a good job at that. And one that I have an article about on my blog is one called Debunk Bot, which it was specifically designed to help people reduce their beliefs in conspiracy theories. And when they tested it, it was actually surprisingly successful. And I think it's worth anyone talking to Debunk Bot just to see how it approaches conversation. I think we have a lot to learn about it, about how to talk to people from it, because it first let the people explain their point of view. It asks why they have these beliefs. And then it repeated their beliefs back to them and asked if it got it right. So it made sure to, I don't know if the word understand is correct to use for an AI, but you know, as humans, we want to make sure that we understand a person's point of view before we argue with them about it. And then it just had conversations with them where it just presented facts, but it never got angry, of course. It n never lost its patience, and it has access to endless information. I mean, of course, we need to keep in mind when talking with an AI that it can make mistakes, of course, but I think we also can learn a lot in terms of how to communicate respectfully and effectively with people who we disagree with, especially if our goal is to help people change their minds or just think about things a little bit differently.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to try out the Debunk Bot, and it really was very interesting and dare I say, fun. I especially liked how it did interact with me and ask me to clarify my point of view. It really kind of made me think about what the position that I was taking was all about, and that it also allowed for a couple follow-up questions to kind of dig a little bit deeper. And it was really fun way to explore some of those ideas. So I encourage wholly encourage folks to check it out.
Yeah, the only thing I don't really like about it, and it's catchy, but the name. But I think the purpose of it was just to explore or to do an experiment on the potential of AI to help people change their minds. But we know that people with conspiracy beliefs are very unlikely to go to a website called Debunk Bot and try to debunk their beliefs. But it is a pretty catchy and memorable name.
I'll talk a little bit about my experience with Debunk Bot too, but I want to add that you could use AI to make your site much more interactive too. It's a good way to do that, and I applaud your thoughts that you're going to go in that direction. I personally believe that we could develop an AI to help tutor us in critical thinking. I'm kind of AI positive. There's a lot of dangers from AI, but those dangers come from the way people are using it rather than the technology itself. But let me just summarize my experience with it a little bit. I could see that people would make up something that they probably didn't believe in just to test it. And there's a big range of conspiracies out there that you could do that on. I got the impression that that's the way that was geared. So I wanted to see what it would do on a contemporary belief, potential conspiracy theory that I would tend to actually believe. By the way, it asks you some questions at first, and then it asks you to type in your conspiracy. And then it starts with that, gives you some feedback. Do I understand your conspiracy right? And presents you with that. And then it goes on and will start to ask you what your evidence is. So it's good in that is it's evidence-based. I'll read you what I typed in there. I said, I believe there is a conspiracy between President Trump and the Heritage Foundation, including individuals such as Russell Voigt, Stephen Miller, and Kevin Roberts, to implement the recommendations of Project 2025 during Trump's term, a plan to drastically expand the executive branch power and reduce government oversight. And this is a dangerous move to authoritarian government in the U.S. That was my conspiracy. I wanted to see what it would do with that. I was a little disappointed in the first round that I did that with, because it actually came back and asked me what my evidence was. And I was working in real time to get, you know, references and stuff to feed it. And I came across an article in Reuters that said something like 260,000 government employees have been laid off since the start of Trump's second term. And I put that as evidence that, you know, this is one of the things that an authoritarian will do, is to begin to bolster his or her power in one way or the other. And a way of doing that is to, what President Trump calls them, deep state. I call them the SHPO state. In other words, those institutions are there for a purpose. They shouldn't be politicized. They have their own missions. And so I put that figure back, 260,000 employees laid off. And it came back saying that far fewer employees have been laid off. And then I went back and I gave the actual reference, two references that verified that. And it chose a reference coming from the Trump administration from the first term. That many employees weren't laid off, but there was an intent to do what he's doing now. So I had to come back and contradict it and say, because it said something like, if he gets elected for a second term. So it was working with old information. So there is some fallibility there. I was discouraged by that. And then it seemed to be going and looking for information to challenge the opposite of what I was saying. So I was accusing it of having its own confirmation of bias. But then I tried it again, giving it the conspiracy. The assassination of Lincoln was a conspiracy between John Wilkes Booth and some other pro-Confederate individuals. And I'll give it a good grade on that, because it came back, instead of trying to find ways of contradicting that, it did come back saying, yes, indeed, that was a conspiracy, and gave the details of that information. So I really applaud what they're doing. It's difficult. AI and these large language models, they're doing amazing things. And so I think that technology would be really good eventually. But you have to be a little careful with it at this point.
And I think there's a bit of a problem with framing it as a debunked bot, because that gives it this goal. It's always got to debunk the conspiracy theory, and it's maybe not open to the possibility that a conspiracy theory could be true. So that's why the one I want to develop would be something more like an explore bot. But of course, there still are limitations in how AI works.
Well, let's get into one other thing, because I want to get a little bit more detail. You were talking about the new courses, Fallacy Detectors Part 2, to get into a whole other group of fallacies. I also saw, and I think you mentioned it, that cognitive biases is another new module that's coming along, and the media literacy. What I'd like you to do is, because it's hard, as we're talking about this, for people to get a real specific, concrete idea of how this works. If you can choose one of those courses and just give us a little tutorial, because I'm really interested in how you develop these courses. Choose one of them, and these are ones that you're currently working on. Give us a little tutorial on what's involved in the process of developing and producing these courses.
Well, I'll talk about Fallacy Detectors Part 2, because that's the next course I want to make, and because I already made Part 1, so I know exactly what went into that one. So the first step is to decide on the fallacies that I want to cover. which I already have a tentative list for part two, and then write a little description of each fallacy with a few examples. Now, for part one, I worked with a writer who was very helpful. His name is Steve French, and he helped give me a lot of guidance in just how to approach this. For part two, whether or not I work with him again, it's just a financial consideration. I would love to, but if I need to cut costs, I might try to just write it myself and see how that goes. And when I say writing, I mean writing the script for the animation. Because in part one, it's a boy and a girl who are going on an adventure through cyberspace to find the lost logic board, to find out why everyone's acting in such an illogical way in cyberspace. So part two would be a continuation of that story. And what happens in every episode is a character commits a logical fallacy, and then something comes on the screen that says fallacy detected, and then I come on the screen and I explain the fallacy. I give a few other examples of where you might encounter the fallacy and what you can say if someone commits the fallacy in your life, how you can respond to it. And then it goes back to the cartoon where they learn from their mistakes, and that's the end of that episode. So the first step would be getting the scripts for the animation, then recording my voice, because I did all the voicing in the animation too, and then sending that to the animator who would start working on it. And the animator, her name is Isabella Frenigia, really, really excellent animator who worked for a reasonable price. So I highly recommend her if anyone's looking for a freelance animator. And in the meantime, when she's working on the animation, then I'm recording my educational part of the video and editing that. By the way, I create educational videos for sale in China, and that's how I earn a living. That's my real job, aside from CritiKid. So luckily I already had the skills for creating and editing videos before starting this project. And then I just edit it all together, make the activities, make the quizzes, and put it all on the site. And fortunately for my husband, since Fallacy Detectors Part 1 is already created, he won't have to do much work for Part 2 because it's already, all the technical work is already done, although Part 1 was quite a lot of work for him. After that, I start advertising on social media. I don't do any paid advertising at this time because when I tried, I felt like it was throwing away money. So I found social media marketing seems to work okay. So that's probably how I will approach it.
That's interesting. Let's move just a moment and talk a little bit about our motivations. I'm going to talk about mine, and Julia might want to chime in here a little bit too. Here at Thinking Clearly, we really prize the process of critical thinking. We've talked a lot about our reasons for that. And I've talked a lot about mine. I'm motivated to encourage and facilitate and advocate for and promote. And, you know, using the word promote sometimes is a little dicey, but I'll own it. I'm so convinced that critical thinking, and more accurately through the use of science and critical thinking, of assessing our reality is in the best benefits of the human species to do. But at times I get frustrated with the lack of critical thinking currently in our public discourse. And so I'd like to know if you get frustrated with it, and Julia can chime in as to whether she gets frustrated with it. What do you think needs to be done about bringing about a more epistemically healthy exchange of ideas and beliefs?
Yes, I do get frustrated, especially on social media, because I'm maintaining a lot of social media profiles. I'm pretty much on every platform, and I check my comment sections. And so, yes, I absolutely get frustrated. I try to ask myself before responding to comments, what do I want to achieve here? I think that's a good thing for any of us to ask before we write a comment on social media. What am I trying to achieve with this? And is this the way to achieve? And is this the best way to achieve it, or the most effective way to achieve it? Because if the goal is to help the person change their minds, being mean to them is, it might feel good, but it's probably not the best way to achieve that goal. Something that I found works really, really well is just to ask questions before arguing with anyone. And sometimes there's not even an argument required if you ask questions. For example, I recently got accused, and I think it was Facebook, of posting anti-Trump content, but I never posted anything about Trump on Facebook. So someone wrote, I like your content, but it's such a shame that you have posted anti-Trump stuff. So I wanted to just say, but I haven't. But then I thought maybe something I posted that, I don't know, something about science or something came off as anti-Trump. So I just asked this person, what content are you referring to? And then he just replied, oh, sorry, I was wrong, because he couldn't find it. So that was a whole fight that was saved just by asking a question. Another example that comes to mind is someone wrote, humans shouldn't be drinking milk because we're not baby cows. And at first I thought, is this the appeal to nature fallacy? That's how it sounded to me. Like, it's not natural, so we shouldn't do it. But that doesn't say anything about the health effects of drinking milk. We should evaluate it based on its health effects. But then I just asked her what she meant, or I think I just said why. And she explained it was an ethical issue that we're taking the milk that doesn't belong to us, that's meant for the baby cows. And I wasn't going to fight with her about that. I'm not going to argue about an ethical stance someone has about a kind of food. It wasn't a logical fallacy. So then that saved me a fight. So I think it's really good to think about what we want to achieve. I keep referring to social media, but, you know, in conversations in general, and ask a lot of questions before any sort of rebuttal or argument. And I think Rappaport's rules for productive disagreement are really helpful. Have you spoken about those before on the show?
Which now?
Rappaport's rules.
I don't think so.
So the first thing that you should do is kind of like what Dibangpa did. You repeat their perspective back to them and ask if you're correct.
Yes. Okay.
Because then you clear up any misunderstandings. Because I think so many arguments happen unnecessarily because the people just don't understand each other's point of view.
Yes.
And an example that comes to mind is people arguing about feminism that actually have the same beliefs. They just have different definitions of what feminism means. And this happens a lot with abstract nouns. We might actually have the same values and beliefs, but understand this abstract term differently and then fight for no reason. So asking questions to understand the person's perspective and then make sure that you're understanding it correctly is a good first step. And then find any points of agreement or things that you've learned from them before any rebuttal.
Yes.
Because then that kind of... It starts off the conversation in a good way. Like, you're not in a fight, you're in a conversation.
I'm staring at my wall here in front of me here. And we've talked about this that we called a LAP, EFI method of having civil dialogues. Listen carefully, ask clarifying open questions, paraphrase to check for understanding, and then when you get into dialogue to the point where you want to give your opinion, you move to all of those three plus expressing your own views and finding common ground and then identifying areas of difference. So, yeah, we're fully on board with, you know, your approach there. And it's difficult to do that sometimes in these trying emotion-packed times. And the other part of that is that at a point in my life, I'm seeing the difference between being the theorist, the person trying to really understand something, but then once you understand it and you have a strong opinion, that there is danger ahead becoming an activist. Julia, do you have anything to add to any of that?
No. One thing, there are similarities, but one thing that stands out to me is earlier on, Stephanie, the method you're talking about, you mentioned agreements kind of earlier in the conversation. And just, I guess, in my anecdotal personal experience, you know, I find that to be really useful as far as having a good faith conversation.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, going back to Bob's original comment, you know, that for me, a lot of my motivation these days is in trying to find good faith conversations, because far too many of them, whether social media or other podcasts, they're just bad faith arguments, kind of dressed up as perhaps good faith discussions. And I find that's one way to really have a good faith common ground to start the conversation from.
I agree with that fully. It's so important. People have told me stories of doctors laughing at them, for example, when they've shared their concerns about vaccines. And this turned them totally anti-vax. This was one woman in particular who eventually changed her mind again. But it was interesting hearing how making fun of her was a big part of what actually made her become more extreme. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people tend to just call people stupid or make fun of them or say there's no getting through with them. You can't reason with them. And this is just not helpful at all. I mean, sometimes we need to, for our mental health, decide not to engage with certain people, especially on social media. But definitely being mean and making fun of people is not a very productive approach.
Well, we're to that point of having to say goodbye. Stephanie Simoes, thank you so much for sharing your ideas and your experiences in teaching critical thinking skills to kids and in developing this online resource for kids, parents, teachers, and all of us, really, to learn and sharpen up our critical thinking tools. So on our website, we're going to link to CritiKid. That's CritiKid.com. And to your account on Instagram. Are there any other links you'd like us to post?
Well, you can find me anywhere on social media by searching CritiKid.
Okay. A big shout out to our listeners. Thanks so much, as always, for your support. And Julia, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time. Keep thinking.
Clearly.